Perhaps the most notable event in the period leading up to the American Civil War was Andrew Jackson's two-term presidency. It changed forever America's political and cultural landscape, and recently historian David Reynolds wrote a book about the era called Waking Giant. I spoke with him on my show this past fall, and we're going to play it for you again now. I began by pointing out that when Andrew Jackson was first elected in 1828, all the presidents who preceded him had come from either Massachusetts or Virginia.
Yeah, there was the Virginia dynasty, so-called dynasty of Washington through Monroe. And then there was the kind of New England Federalist dynasty, John Adams and John Quincy Adams. And Andrew Jackson was the first president who was born in a log cabin, the first from the West.
Tennessee.
From Tennessee, yeah. Then it was the West. And the first from a non-gentry background. So, yeah, he was very much the people's president.
And you've compared the elections of 1824 and 1828 to Bush Gore 2000 and Barack Obama, John McCain now, beyond the fact that Gore got the higher vote and the election was not decided on the basis of that, and the fact that he's from Tennessee, there are other similarities.
Well, what happened is in the election of 1824, actually Jackson won the popular vote,
but not a majority.
And so the election was thrown into the House, and there was an alleged bargain between John Quincy Adams, between Henry Clay, who was one of the candidates, and John Quincy Adams, and a lot of maneuvering in the background, so that in the end, the presidency at that time went to John Quincy Adams. But in a sense, this fueled Andrew Jackson, because a lot of people were very angry. They thought the election had been stolen, and therefore, in the next election, Jackson won.
And it led Jackson to call for an end to the Electoral College. Never changed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So, in what ways was the election in 1828 similar to the current one?
Actually, the 1828 one was between Jackson and John Quincy Adams. Jackson really represented the force of reform, of change. Even though he was a little vague on what reform and change he meant, he often used those words. His followers just plugged those words home and home again. And he was swept in on the basis of this need for change, and it was such. And then the next election, the next two elections were played out against bank crises, which makes even the next two elections, the 1832 and the 1840 elections, rather similar to, in some senses, to the one that's going on now.
Well, I kept on seeing all sorts of parallels throughout this book. If we had looked at another time in American history, could we also have found those parallels, or is this uniquely similar in many ways?
It seems to me that this period when America is just kind of waking up, the book is called Waking Giant, and somehow to me it's almost like today's America in miniature, because for some reason you had so many elements of that culture, the religious cults, the fads, the kind of alternative medicine of that day. All these things were just being kind of planted at that time. So it, in a way, it becomes a kind of laboratory for today's America that you can look back and say, oh, I see where we come from.
Even campaigning.
Yeah,
Jackson was
yeah.
the first president to campaign for the job.
Yes, absolutely.
Was that controversial at the time?
Yeah, it was very controversial. There was, for the first time, campaign imagery was used. And sometimes there was a lot of distortion. What happened in the 1840 election between William Henry Harrison and Martin Van Buren was that actually Van Buren was from a humble background. Harrison was from a very rich background. But somehow it got all twisted up so that Harrison presented himself as a frontiersman. He was from Ohio. And even though he lived on a 300-acre estate there and lived in a mansion, nevertheless, he ran on the idea of being from a log cabin. So that was called the log cabin campaign, and they presented Martin Van Buren as this kind of aristocrat in the White House.
What we call an elitist today.
An elitist. And so it was a completely twisted kind of imagery, but at the same time it shows you the power of populism and populist imagery. And they were trying to make use of the same kind of imagery that Andrew Jackson had won his two elections on in 1828 and 1832, because he ran very much as the people's candidate, the people against the kind of capitalist powers that be, the bankers and all of that.
So he set the standard for campaigning. Did he already did that campaign already introduce negative campaigning? I mean, were there Lee Atwaters and Karl Roves even then?
Yes, absolutely. There was just the 1828 campaign was one of the nastiest in American history. It was charged that Andrew Jackson was supposedly the son of a mulatto woman, and that his brother had been sold as a slave, and then they charged John Quincy Adams with having been a kind of pimp when he was in Russia. It got very, very low and very nasty.
Pimp in Russia?
Yeah, that he had. He had been a diplomat in Russia, and the idea that he had introduced a young lady to the Tsar of Russia, sort of trading sexual favors from her for certain things that he wanted from the Tsar. It was completely fabricated, but it was a real mudslinging campaign.
David S. Reynolds is Distinguished Professor at the Graduate Center of City University in New York, and he's written any number of books. The most recent, the one we're discussing now, is called Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson, published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, it was also a time when penny newspapers were becoming popular. Were they the equivalent of today's tabloids?
Yes, the penny newspapers, they were called penny because they sold for 1 cent, as opposed to the previous newspapers, which had sold for 6 cents. And these were cheap.
That's like the Times at $1.50 today.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. And these were the cheap newspapers. They feasted on anything sensational, any mysterious disappearance, or let's say incest by a clergyman on three of his daughters, or anything like that, a double suicide. The kind of headless body and topless bar kind of syndrome that we sometimes have today in the tabloids. And they were the originators of that whole kind of tabloid sensation. And it was also the world in which Edgar Allan Poe, who kind of took it in a different direction, but still he kind of feasted on this sort of sensational culture of his day. And he was very much involved in the newspapers.
So we're seeing the development of modern culture, the America that we know. These are the early days when all of these things are starting to be created.
Yes.
We'd mentioned campaigning. Also, didn't Jackson run his presidency differently? Didn't he actually change the way a president uses power?
He was the first president who really used the veto power a lot. He used the veto more often than all the presidents before him combined. Some people looked upon him as a despot, as an autocrat, as a tyrant. But he was very, very forceful in exercising his views. And therefore, in a way, he gave birth to the kind of strong, very strong executive office that we know today.
Well, you talked about the economic crisis of the time. I know this is hypothetical, but do you have a sense of how he would have handled an economic crisis of the sort that we're now experiencing?
He would have. He was very much against a central bank. He would have definitely gone after the so-called fat cat salaries of the investment bankers. He was very much of today what we would call a left wing, or left of center at least. And he definitely would have tried to get rid of any kind of wasteful greed or profit taking on the part of capitalists. He was the one who really introduced the whole rhetoric, or at least he popularized the whole rhetoric of the working class against the excessively rich. And he absolutely would have tried to rein in the kind of freewheeling, capitalist profit-taking.
Well, nowadays, many people associate Andrew Jackson with his advocacy of the removal of Native American populations to the West, both before and during his years in office. And he was also a slave owner, wasn't he?
Yes, he owned more than 50 slaves. You have to put him in context, however, because, I mean, there's no apologizing, really, for his treatment of the Native Americans.
And he said they should be treated humanely, but in fact they weren't.
No, they weren't. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of them were shipped west, were forced along the Trail of Tears. However, I will say, not that I'm defending him at all, because you can't defend him, but basically all presidents from Jefferson onward wanted to do something similar to that, and Jefferson even said, "We're going to have to push the Indians beyond the Rocky Mountains." And then president after president kind of waffled on the issue, but basically wanted to do the same thing. And Jackson thought that by reserving these reservations in the West and giving them new homes in the West, that somehow that was good enough and they could go there. He had adopted an Indian boy in his own private life and cared for him. He was very paternalistic, both to this Native American adopted son and also to his slaves. But still, alas, racism in that day was absolutely pervasive. There were only really a handful of people who were progressive on the issue of race. And so he very much reflected his era on the issue of race.
Well, what position did he take on the debate between the North and South on slavery?
With slavery, he took the position that so many presidents did. He didn't really want to defend the South too much. He didn't want to offend the North. He took a very middling position. He was basically pro-slavery, but a little bit like, Jefferson had owned slaves, and yet Jefferson said all men are created equal, and yet he owned slaves.
And Washington wanted to free his slaves, but kept them for his wife, he said.
That's right. Well, so many of the early presidents and Supreme Court justices and members of Congress, they owned slaves. So General Jackson, Jackson was just doing what was normal. He tried to kind of, in a way, Band-Aid over the slavery issue, as did so many presidents until the Civil War, until Abe Lincoln came along and put his foot down and said, and the South seceded, and at that point we had the Civil War. But Jackson struck the compromise.
Was the Missouri Compromise effected during his presidency?
Well, before his presidency, yeah. That drew a line right across the country. And above it, slavery was not allowed. Below it, it was allowed. But that was just, he was president during that period of the Missouri Compromise.
So these compromises, in a way, as you said, stabilized the situation. We might have had a civil war before if Jackson hadn't done this, and then other presidents carried it on.
Right.
And then Lincoln finally said, well, this is an unacceptable situation. I'm sure it was. Eventually, it just couldn't be sustained any longer.
And even Lincoln didn't want a war, because Lincoln in 1858 said, well, it might take 100 years for slavery to disappear, if you can imagine us having slaves in 1958 here in America. So even Lincoln didn't really want war, per se. And no one could really predict the severity of the Civil War. But still, they were trying to avoid any kind of armed conflict over it.
Yeah. I want to talk about some of the other things that happened during this time, like something you've alluded to, this incredible religious fervor that suddenly swept the nation, and a new sense of manifest destiny, some of the other things really did set in motion pretty much what America became. But we'll take a little break first. My guest is David S. Reynolds. His book, Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson, published by Harper. We're back with David S. Reynolds, who's a distinguished professor at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. His books include John Brown, Abolitionist, Walt Whitman's America, all, by the way, prize winners, Beneath the American Renaissance, and now Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson, published by Harper. And we mentioned that religious fervor seemed to sweep over the country at the time. Why do you think so many churches flourished at that moment?
What happened was that when there was a separation of church and state after the American Revolution and the disestablishment of American religion, Protestantism just, in a way, went crazy. There was just so many cults and sects and denominations that proliferated with this democratizing and loosening up of religion. And you had both a kind of a splintering within a lot of the major churches, but at the same time, a lot of self-styled prophets who thought they were literally God, and they were walking around. And this is when also you had the rise of polygamous cults and sects, and there was a lot of controversy over polygamy at that time. And I trace a lot of this in my book.
But some of the religious groups that started then succeeded, others failed. Why do you think the Methodists did so well?
The Methodists held huge camp meetings, which were huge revivals, and they were so emotional. People would scream and yell. In a way, there wasn't quite as much or nearly as much entertainment in those days, and there was just a lot of sheer entertainment and feeling and passion, almost like some of these revivals were like the Woodstocks of yesteryear, so to speak. So,
I mean, more than what we see today with televangelists?
Yeah, I mean, the televangelist ones, they can get emotional, but generally they're much more staid and calm, actually, than was going on. I mean, back then people would literally do all kinds of strange exercises with their body and hop around and jump around and get on all fours and bark and so forth. They thought they were literally possessed by God and they were trying to get rid of Satan. So it was such an emotional kind of situation. But this really caught fire. This caught fire. And the average people really loved this kind of heartfelt religion.
Now, that sort of thing occurs still today in many churches, in the charismatic churches.
That's right. That's right.
So do we go through waves, or did this set in motion something that has just been a constant in American culture?
It's a little like the stock market. It goes up and down. But between about 1805 and 1845, there was a huge wave of revivals and then kind of a dying down. And then it goes through periods of resurgence. Today, it's a little more institutionalized, where you can go to one church and there will be extreme passion. Another church will be quite staid.
Somebody
and calm.
Will be slain in the spirit. Another person, they call a sedity church.
Exactly, yeah. And then the televangelists on TV are generally, they can be very emotional, but often they're in large auditoriums. And sometimes people will come on stage and fall down and so forth. But those are kind of somewhere in the middle, really, in terms of the amount of fervor that people actually exhibit in their bodies and so forth.
Did the Unitarians have a hard time because they didn't do this sort of thing?
The Unitarians were basically rationalists who believed in good works and reason. And therefore, yeah, they didn't have the mass appeal. They were always kind of a Boston liberal kind of religion, and although they, also spread out a little bit, they were very culturally influential, but they had much less fervor.
Divine providence played a role in how Americans viewed the right to their land. How did manifest destiny and the idea that the U.S. was a chosen nation affect political decisions at the time?
The big fight in that day was whether we should actually make war against Mexico to take over the huge territories in the West that included New Mexico, California, many other states in the West, which were then under the control of Mexico. And those who believed in manifest destiny, and these were the people who finally won politically, said, let's march out there, let's conquer these territories. And they did in the Mexican War. They conquered those territories. So manifest destiny was the idea that we were destined by God to spread democracy throughout America, yes, but also by implication also elsewhere.
And they saw certain things that were happening as signs, odd things like John Adams and Thomas Jefferson dying the same day.
Yeah, they died on July 4th, 1826, just 50 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, and they died within hours of each other. So that seemed like divine providence.
Yeah. And here we're talking about the spreading of American democracy, something that we've been hearing about recently.
Yeah,
we going through a Jacksonian time and not knowing it?
Well, I think I have thought so much of the Jacksonian period. For example, with the war in Iraq, the idea that it's a really good and perhaps God-sent idea to spread democracy or some form of it in Iraq. And there, even to this very day, there is that kind of underpinning of manifest destiny that is in the consciousness or sometimes the unconscious mind of so many Americans.
This is also a time when the self-help mentality developed. I'm not saying Oprah comes out of that, but it seems to me that as I go through the list of things that were occurring during this time, I see all pretty much the basics of our culture set into motion, although I think we're a little more sophisticated about some of them today.
Now all of this is
science, another one.
Yeah, science. The self-help culture arose at that time. At that time, there were many forms of alternative medicine that were just coming up, and self-help forms of medicine, homeopathy, and also not acupuncture, but the kind of pre-self-help culture, and also forms of the vitamin shops with all kinds of herbs. I mean, today we would call it snake oil or something, but because we're a little more sophisticated in our understanding of vitamins. But still, that kind of mentality that you can kind of fix it yourself definitely arose in that period.
And there was also a greater interest in science. A lot of new inventions at this point.
A lot of new inventions. This was the period of the railroad, the daguerreotype, which was the photograph. The sewing machine was invented in this period. The stapler, the telegraph came in 1844. And this was a very anesthesia came in the early 1840s. This was a moment when so many new inventions came along.
Wasn't the Jacksonian era also a time of great reform? For example, there was prison reform, wasn't there? The way criminals were treated changed.
Yes. And their prison reform today might seem rather cruel, but actually in their day, it was considered very benign. There were two basic kinds of prison, one in which they put you in solitary confinement for as long as your period was and put a hood over your head, and you just were there and you couldn't correspond with any other prisoners.
You're talking about Abu Ghraib, aren't you?
That was the so-called Cherry Hill model. And then there was the Auburn model, where you got into a 6-foot by 7-foot cell, and then you were often with other people, but you couldn't talk. Now, that sounds really cruel.
That's the Guantanamo model,
right. These things foresee certain things that are happening today. But if you compare that actually with previous prisons, that was considered relatively benign, amazingly so. But
because they used to be totally cruel punishment.
Oh, just...
despite what the Constitution had promised?
Yeah, I would say up until around 1815, even after the Constitution, there was just so much... institutionalized abuse of prisoners, and they were just treated so cruelly. So even these rather harsh, what we would call harsh models were relatively benign.
This the period when the temperance movement also took off?
Yes. The alcohol consumption was astounding. There was more spent on alcohol in 1820 than the federal government spent on anything. So if you can imagine that. And Americans drank on the average of between 7 and 8 gallons of raw alcohol a year. I mean, if you boil it down. So the temperance movement, and also when you were working, generally they would give you 11 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the afternoon to take off and go and drink, and then you come back to work. That was just considered part of work. So the temperance movement had a very real foe there in alcohol abuse. And it was a tremendous movement. It led eventually to prohibition, of course.
But that was 100 years later.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the first forms of prohibition came in the 1850s, and then there was a national campaign after that led eventually to prohibition.
What were sexual attitudes at the time?
The sexual attitudes were kind of divided. On the one hand, there was extreme prudishness, so much so that they would cover up piano legs. And
I thought that was a Victorian thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was shared both in Victorian England and in America. Also, underpants were called inexpressibles, and nude statues in museums were often covered with gauze and so forth. So there was extreme prudishness, but at the same time, ironically, that gave rise to sort of excessive prostitution, because what happened once a young woman fell, that was the end. And she might as well become a prostitute. according to this kind of cult of purity.
Because there was no place for her in respectable society.
Yeah, in a way she had sort of gone to hell. And so between over 10% of young women in New York between the ages of 18 and 35 prostituted for a certain amount of time. And they used to actually walk around the city. They were very gaudy about it. And they would sort of display themselves. So it was kind of a bifurcated situation.
You write in the book that there was an overconfidence about what we knew.
Yeah.
And people, they already thought that we had pretty much resolved all the problems of the world?
Yes. For example, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "All wars have ceased." Of course, this is before the Civil War came, and then everybody knew that all wars had not come to an end. But basically that we're getting more and more progressive. We're becoming more and more scientific, more and more enlightened, and therefore we'll be able to solve everything rationally. And this was the fundamental attitude of so many Americans back then, and there was a real optimism.
Now, Ralph Waldo Emerson spoke out against the Jacksonian Democrats. What was his beef with them?
Ralph Waldo Emerson was a philosopher from Connecticut. He was the leading intellectual of his day. And he had a very twisted relationship with the Jacksonians because he thought they were kind of low and vulgar. But at the same time, there was a side of him that was also attracted to that. And just as Nabokov went on buses to overhear teenagers chattering in their slang as he wrote Lolita, so sometimes Emerson would go through the back streets of Boston and overhear common workers to talk just so he could enliven his language. So he actually sometimes would criticize Jackson, but at the same time appreciated the democratic nature of the Jacksonians.
Well, he also found fault with the opposition party, the Whigs.
Yes. He ultimately thought that they were a little stuffy and bloodless. The whole war between the Democrats and the Whigs was partly a class war, with the Jacksonians identifying with the common people and the Whigs with more the institutionalized and middle class or upper middle class people.
Well, some of our greatest writers come out of this time. Do you think it's because of all of this ferment we've been talking about?
Yeah, I think that one reason why I wrote my book is that I want to understand why it was that Emerson, Thoreau, Melville, Hawthorne, Edgar Allan Poe, Walt Whitman, and just a little bit later, Emily Dickinson, why do all these unbelievably great writers emerge at this period? And I really attribute it so much to the moment in time, the culture. A combination of the kind of explosion of creativity and all the reform and religion we've been talking about and all the movements, they kind of come together in their works.
But also it sounds to me like a lot of questioning. Emerson, a perfect example, maybe even more so Henry David Thoreau, who moved to Walden Pond, wrote about living life simply after he had worked in his father's pencil factory. You get the feeling that he was questioning this booming new capitalism and this new technology.
Thoreau is a good example of a genius who found his moment at the right time, because he arose just at the moment when capitalism was just kind of kicking in. And you could have a solitary person like that because capitalism was not this kind of overwhelming force that we're all sort of in a way subject to today. It was just at the very beginning, and he felt he could almost put a finger in the dam and prevent this kind of explosion of materialism that we're very accustomed to today, materialism and the consumption mentality. But he was at the very beginning of that, and he really believed that by moving back to Walden, living alone in the woods and simplifying his life, that he could somehow stop this whole hurtling toward materialism.
Were Americans feeling that we were the equal of Europe? Because not all that much later, artists were going to England to get their training even then. And then we have later in the century, we have all those American writers who become expats in England or other countries in Europe. Were we proud of the writers we were creating at this point?
We had a kind of inferiority complex, but at the same time, this inferiority complex, as it does so often in people, produced a kind of exaggerated nationalism among American writers like Herman Melville, Emerson, Thoreau. So on the one hand, They were very aware of the whole tradition of European literature, but at the same time, they wanted to affirm a real Americanness and find American themes, which is why someone like Walt Whitman, who called himself, "I am Walt Whitman, an American, I'm one of the roughs, I'm one of the people," and so forth. So,
but doesn't he really come into his own after the Civil War?
Yeah, he does. He does. I mean, ironically, he is picked up in England and in a way shipped back to America. That happened quite a lot, that American writers weren't as well received at home. And then in a way, they became pets over in Europe, and then they got shipped back and reappreciated here in America. So, yeah.
In fact, that also happened with other American things. Modern architecture developed in Chicago. It wasn't until the Europeans started emulating the Americans and shipped it back to us that we appreciated it.
It even happened with Edgar Allan Poe, who we think of as really an American writer, but it was really when the French and some of the English picked up on Poe that then it gets people in America say, "Hey, this guy really was a great writer." But in his own time, he was just another magazine writer. You know?
Now, you could have written a biography of Andrew Jackson, couldn't you? Why did you decide to write with the equivalent of a history of an era or a biography of an era? Yeah.
Well, Andrew Jackson remains at the very heart of my book, and he's a huge presence in my book. However, there have been many very fine biographies of Jackson, and even there have been books on the Jacksonian period, but there's been no book that comprehensively looks at that entire period, all the movements, reform movements, all the cultural activities that were so important and that are still alive today. So I really wanted to capture the variety of Jacksonian America.
Well, this is a cusp period, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, absolutely. This is America today, but in miniature, in miniature, just so many things. The first advertising agency came up during this era. The whole idea of the first department stores came during this era. You could go down almost down the list and produce so many things that are around us today, but it's a great laboratory for looking at where we came from.
And is this the period where American institutions, America starts creating its own institutions rather than just simply importing things from Europe?
Yes. Well, this, for example, we began some very important scientific expeditions that resulted in the Smithsonian Institution that was established in the 1840s. This was the time when a lot of colleges, universities become established, and this was the time when the idea of a national bank, not the Federal Reserve, that wouldn't come till later, but there were, and also corporations. This was the time when the stock exchange was started. So so many institutions.
We invented the stock exchange?
No, there had been a stock exchange in London previously, so we didn't invent that. But it was a part of rising corporate culture that was happening both in England, to some degree in France, but also in America. And so the stock exchange, corporations, all these institutions began to arise during this period.
So all the troubles that we have experienced most recently can be traced back to this period in history. David S. Reynolds is Distinguished Professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, author of a number of award-winning history books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Just great coming.